You're listening to Face Off, episode 105, recorded January 24th, 2011. This episode of Face Off is brought to you by AgileTask. AgileTask is a task tracking application featuring an agile workflow, tagging for organization and achievements. AgileTask, your lightweight personal backlog tool. Check it out by going to agiletask.me. And RocketShipIt. RocketShipIt, the complete web-based multi-carrier shipping solution for small businesses and developers. Shipping rates, integrated tracking, and labels for UPS, FedEx, and USPS shippers. RocketShipIt is shipping made easy. Go to rocketshipit.it. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I am your other host, Mark Sanborn.
Prestigious host, Mark Sanborn. In this podcast, we talk about web technology, and we talk about things like web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, if you want to get the show notes to this episode, if you want to check out some links or look at some of the stuff we talked at, go to faceoffshow.com. You can find it all there. Things like, you know, if you hear about an awesome geek tool we have and you want to talk about that or get a link to that, all kinds of cool stuff there, eh, Mark?
Yep. It's a good place to go. Check out our previous episodes. There's a big list of all of them on one page.
Yes,
so you can go kind of browse through and pick a topic that you like and visit a past episode.
Yeah, and there's over 100 of them, so, you know, you can spend all day there. No big deal.
So this is episode 105.
Yep.
We've been up there. Soon we'll be at 200 and be like, what is going on?
It won't even be a big deal. Just be like, it's 200. No big deal. The first 100 came so easy. Second 100 is just going to be awesome. So, all right. Hey, Mark, let's get into our geek tool of the week. One of the things that we've been talking about, our sort of theme, our overarching theme for these past couple episodes on Geek Tool of the Week is learning to cook for yourself. I'm a bad example of this because I didn't cook dinner myself tonight, but I went to Subway, which was delicious. Think Fresh. Maybe we could get them to sponsor the show, and then this whole geek tool sort of tangent will be completely worthless. It'll be like, don't cook your own food. Eat Subway. Eat Fresh.
You don't want to be doing dishes. Just go to Subway.
A sharp knife or not, you still got to wash that sucker. Get some delicious food at Subway. Wow. Okay, they better sponsor the show after that. Anyways, trying to help people, you know, if you, you know, aren't cooking, trying to give you some of the tips that Mark and I have been learning to try and become sort of better and more skilled in the kitchen. Let's get into the geek tool that we have this week to help you cook is an instant read thermometer. The particular model that we have that is on the cheap is if you just need one, you want to get an instant read thermometer because they're fast. You want to put it in whatever you're checking the temperature of. You want it to read fast. You don't want to have to wait very long. So that's why you want to get an instant read. And the one that we picked specifically to talk about is the Taylor 9842 commercial waterproof digital thermometer. This is
an instant read one with the digital?
Yeah.
This isn't one of those that takes like 4 or 5 minutes.
It's in the instant read thermometer category, and it's got 207 customer reviews with 4 stars. So I had a feeling it was pretty battle hardened. See, the problem is with a lot of instant read is kind of a thing people say. It doesn't really mean anything. There isn't like a specification for instant read thermometers. Usually I think kind of the thing for most people is digital tends to be instant read. Instant is of course a variable thing. So,
right.
You know, I got the gist from this, that the Taylor one was fast enough. I don't know if you've ever used a non-digital one. You put it like in the meat and it sits and goes like ding, 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 and slowly moves up. It's painful.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm looking at the reviews and it says that, you can get a read within 10 seconds.
And that's good enough.
These are like actual people using it. So that's very cool. I tried mine, I think it was yesterday or the day before. And it was like, I don't know. It felt like it was just, you know, heating up at the same rate as the pan was heating up. So it was ridiculous. It felt like it was at least 4 minutes before. Yeah.
Well, and a lot of these, the key with the instant read thermometer is it's not like a meat thermometer that you can put in the oven with the meat. You pull out your meat, mm-hmm. you stick your instant read in, it tells you the temperature. The cool one about this Taylor one is it's rugged. It's got like a little thing to put to slide the thermometer into. And let's get into why knowing temperature is critical. Knowing temperature is critical if you are cooking meats. Sometimes if you're into candy making, candy thermometers are really important. A lot of things like, you know, casseroles is like heat up to this temperature, and it's good to know your temperatures. Specifically with meat, this is where meat tends to be the big one where you really want to know the temperature because, 10 degrees, pulling it out at a particular temperature, you know, 10 degrees pro or minus can mean the difference between something that is entirely too raw or entirely too rare and something that is way overcooked. Because, you know, like with a lot of meats, they continue to cook once you pull them out. So if you pull it out the right temperature, then it has time to sort of finish cooking by itself and then start cooling off and be proper temperature for serving. That's just how you tell whether or not. There are different ways. Like with meat, you can do like the poke test, I've heard it called, where you sort of poke the meat. Once you get used to it, you'll kind of be able to notice based on sort of how it pokes, whether or not it's done. But especially if you're doing roasts or anything where there's a lot of deep meat and you need to check the temperature inside something, like if you're roasting a turkey for Thanksgiving or something, you really want to check deep in the thigh. You're going to need a thermometer like this.
All right, so this is the $12 version. $12. What do we got in the more pricey range?
Let's say if you're wanting to spend money because you realize how important it is to check your temperature, we have the next one. The more expensive model is the ThermoPen, and this is like the ultimate instant read thermometer. It's what they use on Cook's Illustrated and America's Test Kitchen. It'll give you a reading in like 3 seconds. It's got a big digital readout display. The other one we have is kind of a small display. The ThermoPen has a nice big digital display. The pen that you poke in to actually check the temperature like folds up. They call it a ThermoPen because you can sort of like you click it back to the side so it doesn't have, you don't have this big metal thing poking out in your drawer or anything, and it fits in your drawer really nice and small. It is $83, and it is definitely the way to go if you have the money to spend on an awesome instant read thermometer. Little above my price range, to be honest with you. It's not that critical to me.
Yeah, I'm kind of with
you. Well, temperature is, but having a super fast reading, I mean, the difference between 3 seconds and like 10 seconds, I can handle.
Yeah. So, but good entry points there. If you tend to use your thermometers a lot, maybe look at this one.
Yeah, one thing I did.
It is definitely the pro, you know, the one to have.
Yeah, and another thing to think about this, and I don't know about the Taylor, but when America's Test Kitchen was testing instant read thermometers, I remember specifically they picked the ThermoPen too because not only did it fold, did it read fast, have a big display, but also it was accurate. I mean, you have to worry about some of these cheaper ones sometimes. You have to wonder if they actually are accurate. I mean, like a lot of times, even your oven and stuff, you really need to put like an oven thermometer in because you want to check sometimes your oven, you put it at 300 degrees, and really your oven is kind of crappy, and it's going between, you know, 280 and 320. And like, that's a big temperature variance that you need to be aware of. So check your temperatures, super important. And I love to barbecue. So, and if you're grilling, you got to know when it's done. And I think a thermometer is essential and really helpful. So, there's been a couple times I pulled stuff off the grill or whatever when it was maybe not done enough and it was a little raw, and I just, That look on my wife's face when she cut into the meat could have been avoided by simply checking the temperature. So that is a note to self. Let's get into our web apps. Our first web app this week, I was really excited about this because for me, it really fits sort of the Agile Task mantra. It's called Thought Boxes. It's thoughtbox.es. And it's like this, it's an amazing little app where you... how do I get to, I want to get started now. There we go. What it does is you basically create these sort of super containers of things that you, goodness, what is going on here? Once you're logged in, it's kind of hard to get back to your stuff. Okay, so you create these trains of thought, which is like, so I have a train of thought called Agile Task. And what you do in this train of thought is you just add boxes and everything you can select the color to. And you just, so like, you know, it's a very flexible tool. You just add boxes and you add thoughts inside these boxes. So you can kind of categorize and sort things out however you want. It reminds me a lot of Agile Task because the whole point of Agile Task is just you have two buckets, but however you organize using tags or whatever after that is totally up to you. And this is definitely like that. You just have these trains of thought, and inside the trains of thought, there are boxes with thoughts inside of them. Super easy, really great design. And I like this sort of flexibility to do and organize things how I like.
Very cool. Can you do collaboration with it? Like a single thing?
Well, if you have the pay version, they say you can share them. I don't think you can collaborate on them. But you can share them. I think you can send a link to people. It's $15 a year. You know, holy smokes, that's only $1.25 a month. You get unlimited thoughts and trains and everything.
This would be great for a brainstorming tool as well.
Absolutely.
It's just kind of, you know, pick a thought and go for it, and then pick another thought and add some.
Exactly. And I kind of like this idea of web apps that basically mimic the flexibility of pen and paper systems. Like, you know, this is very similar to like, you know, post-it notes on a board or something. You know, a lot of these apps have these really complex systems where you have to really conform to their system to do it. And that's one of the things we sort of rejected with AgileTask, because it was like, let's make this sort of dead simple system and let people, you know, interact with it how they want and see what sort of emergent behavior comes. And this is kind of an app that's like that too. It's like, why, you know, oh, you could use Google Docs for this. It's like, no, this is just a very basic concept that you can develop whatever system you want in that concept without having to shoehorn or do, you know, I don't have to put in a thought ID and then a thought, you know, date and a thought tag or anything. You know, this is literally just, you know, add thoughts to boxes inside a train of thought.
Very cool.
Yeah, very cool. I like it. I like these their design and their sort of their attitude. Very upbeat. A lot like how we work. So that's great to hear them. Let's get on to our next web app, which is the Fixr Cost Guide. You can get this by going to fixr.com and click on Cost Guides. This is a really cool web app because the whole web app is kind of interesting, but I specifically like the cost guides because what it does is let you sort of pick home repair projects or things and basically kind of figure out the ballpark that it might cost, which, you know, for someone like me, let's say, I mean, I don't own a house right now, and if I ever even did own a house, I would have no idea what it would cost to, like, you know, build a greenhouse or put up a swimming pool fence. And this app is sort of designed to try and help you, or this part of their app, anyways, is sort of designed to help you sort of price it out and at least get a ballpark. So what's a project? I'm going to click pave a driveway. Let's say I have a driveway and I need to get it paved. It's like, man, I don't even know what that costs. So I can click on that. And, it, you know, outdoor, you know, how much does it cost to pave a driveway? Over the side, they have their typical cost, which is $800 to $1,500 for a particular size. I can even click on my state. Like, it has some statistics, like Montana is usually 30% less than, you know, the average. So I can click on that, and it says in Montana, it should cost, you know, between $560 and $1,050 to pave a driveway. It'll kind of go through and talk about it, and it'll tell you, like, the things that you need to do, like excavation, clearing, tree chipping and removal, grading it, and then actually paving it, and then additional considerations. And then if you want, and this is sort of the business model of the app that I kind of don't really, I'm not sure how comfortable I am with it. You can get cost estimates from contractors and let them actually sort of bid on your project and then select a contractor through the app. I haven't really heard anything else of that, but the whole cost guide section I think is completely useful. I mean, Mark, what do you think? I mean, you're a homeowner, and you do a lot of these things yourself. But I mean, do you find this useful? Like, if you're like, man, I'm tired of having to do this all by myself, I might want to pay someone to do it. What would that cost?
Well, the first thing that I see here that's really useful is the estimated cost based on your area. Not just to install it, but just the overall cost. Sometimes as a do-it-yourselfer like I am, I look at, like, you know, building a fence or installing a garage door opener, and I just go to Lowe's or something and I see the price of a garage door opener and I say, oh, it's, you know, $125. But, you know, how many hours? This is great because it tells kind of what to expect if you do want to kind of do it yourself. They have a site according to DIYornot.com, which is maybe a web app we might want to check out.
They have a couple sources, though. I was wondering that as well, and I looked at a couple, and they actually, I feel like this is content that they actually wrote, but, like, went out and searched for sort of costs on it.
Uh-huh. So, like, in the case where you're purchasing a garage door opener, it gives you tips on selecting an opener. Oftentimes, if you're a homeowner and you're wanting to contract this out and say, you know, I want to install a new garage door opener, he might just install one. He might not ask you. It would be good to check out this site and know the difference. You know, the belt driven ones are a little bit quieter than the chain ones, but they're going to cost you a little bit more. You know, understand the features, understand what goes into it, maybe get a cost estimate on the site before you talk to somebody so you kind of know a ballpark figure. I think those are the main things. Not sure if I would use, you know, living in Montana, sometimes these web apps are limited to the more populated areas. Absolutely. And so I'm not sure I would use the estimate feature of the site, but there's some great content here.
I don't know. Yeah, one thing I had is I was looking at their pricing model. And so if you're a user, your average user, like I'm just a guy, and I want to try and get estimates for a project, it's free, which is really cool. So they end up charging the contractor, the worker, if they end up getting the job based on the thing. And they had a 5% commission. And I guess this is where my ignorance comes in, is I don't know if that's high or not. And you're totally right. How many people, you know, you went to the contractor index. They have a contractor index. There is none in Montana. Okay. So that's not useful to me anyways. But, you know, is 5% too much? The truth is, I don't know. So I really can't judge that part of the web app. I think, you know, and if I did have a house and there was contractors in Montana, I would be very interested in this because it's hard to figure out who to find, or I don't know anything about that stuff at all. So any way that this can help me is super useful. But the cost guides themselves, I think, are excellent. And, you know, sort of the thing is, like, if you're in, you know, sidewalk repair cost, like from right there, if you really want to, get estimates. Just put a, you know, put your describe your project, put your email, your phone, and see what drops in. I mean, it doesn't hurt for you, and it doesn't hurt them to even put bids. It only costs them money if you accept their bid, and even then, it's just 5% of the bid value. So, you know, it doesn't hurt to put your feelers out there and see if there is anybody out there that wants to do it. But I just don't know enough of that to really review that part of the web app. But the cost guides are pretty awesome. I thought they were really useful.
Yeah, I think they're useful enough to you know, check out this web app. So
absolutely. Hey, you out there listening to the show, if you have some news, follow-up, geek tool, or web app you think we should look at, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. There you can find all the different ways to get a hold of us on Twitter. You can email studio@faceoffshow.com. And then, oh man, what was it? We actually had someone tweet us out this week who was a guy we know. Let me look it up. It was something. It was in reference to our past episode. Hold up here. Levi Baker.
A lot of good
Go ahead.
Oh. I was going to say, we get a lot of good feedback on Twitter and through the comments and stuff.
Absolutely.
Always appreciate that.
Levi Baker says, Extreme Software and Used Car Emporium Incorporated sound like awesome places to work. And I agree. I'm going to go register those LLCs right now. Extreme. Remember that? Extreme programming.
Yeah, extreme programming.
So if I don't hear about an Extreme Programming Incorporated sometime soon, I'm going to be severely disappointed. And with that in mind, talking about extreme programming, which is an agile approach to software development philosophies. Let's go into part three about our development software development philosophies.
All right. So I think this is our first part three episode we've ever had. So like the third consecutive episode on a single topic. And we wanted to do that because we wanted to give Scrum and another special one we're going to talk about later, a good quality, good quality time, because Scrum is a pretty big player in the agile development philosophy work space. So we're talking about Scrum first. I actually didn't know this, but I started looking up some Scrum stuff, and it actually comes from rugby. It's a term in rugby. It's where ways you can get into Scrum is if the ball goes out of bounds somehow. And they reboot the game by, they all kind of get into, it almost looks like they're
it's like a hunched over circle.
Each other. Yeah,
they get in this circle where they're hunched over with their hands over each other, and the ball's thrown in the middle, and then it's just sort of like this big free for all of everybody sort of attached at their hands trying to get to the ball, and I think trying to kick it out of the circle of people. I don't know. Yeah. It's very intense either way.
Yeah, it's interesting. You have to check out the video that we're going to put in the show notes just for fun. So we'll get into the Scrum stuff, the daily stand-up meeting. I noticed in Scrum, they have a daily stand-up meeting, which means, you know, as it sounds, you stand up during your meeting, which can have some benefits just by itself. You know, nobody wants to stand for an hour. So oftentimes the meetings are shorter. In Scrum seems to use a lot of time boxing, and that's a productivity strategy of limiting time and telling everybody ahead of time that, you know, we're only going to be talking about this for 15 minutes. So let's, you know, stay on track and
totally
get going. So they have a daily stand-up meeting, which is time boxed to 15 minutes each day. The three main questions that they want to ask each person that's attending the meeting is, you know, what have you done since yesterday? You know, what are you planning on doing today? And do you have any problems that are preventing you from accomplishing, you know, the overall goals or the features that you're working on? Mm-hmm. Those three questions keep everybody on topic and kind of get to the root of the problem. Like, you know, what's going on and what are we doing today? Mm-hmm. And, you know, is there anything that's roadblocking? You know, is stuff not working?
Yeah, those are three things that really help the team know what everyone else is doing and what might be blocking you. So, you know, what have you done since yesterday? Okay, well, that's what you got done yesterday. You know, a retrospective look back. What did you get done? What are you planning to do today? So, you know, like if one day you say, I'm going to plan on do this, and the next day you don't get that done, you know, you gain a lot of information by that too. Like, oh, well, I thought that was going to be easier than I thought it was going to be. And then also, you know, let your teammates know that, you know, what you're going to be doing today, what, you know, it communicates that. And then basically do you have any problems preventing you from accomplishing your goal is the, you know, so you don't get the guy that's just sitting around going like, gosh, I wish so-and-so would get done with their thing so I can work on this one thing because I just am going to sit here and spin my wheels, which can be a big problem sometimes. I mean, I've definitely seen it more than I ever thought I would. It's something that you just kind of like, I mean, I've done it where I just kind of sit and I'll just put that, you know, this task on the back burner being like, oh, so-and-so knows that they need to get this done before I can, so I'll just kind of sit and work on some other stuff or do some research, you know, because you never really, you know, you always have time. You always have something else to do. So, but then all of a sudden, it's like 3 weeks later, and it's like, hey, why didn't this get done? Oh, well, Jim, I was just waiting for you to finish that one little feature thing. And he's like, oh, well, I didn't even prioritize it. And that's really important to do.
I also see the importance of having a daily meeting as opposed to like a weekly. I remember weekly meetings it's just there's so much stuff to talk about in a weekly meeting. And oftentimes, the more things you have to talk about, the more chances to get off topic and things. And, you know, and also having a daily meeting, things come out faster. So problems come out in meetings faster than waiting till the end of the week to find out that someone's been blocking you from
totally,
you know, getting your goals done. So yeah, very good sound advice there.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny when you think about, like, I look at the weekly meetings that I've had in the past and it's like, what is a big chunk of it? Well, a big chunk of it, they always start as we're just going to talk about what you're doing, what you did this week. And that always spins off in these other crazy conversations because it's a week. You want to cram this all this stuff into 1 hour of a week. Well, this way, it's just a little bit, 15 minutes every day. It's, you know, that's just a hiccup in your day. And you do it every day. And so you have this sort of timeline of the entire week. And then really, if you do have to have any other meetings there, they could be more strategic planning meetings with only the people that need to be there. You know, you can break out of that meeting and be like, okay, well, I am having trouble with this. Okay, well, let's just talk about this after this meeting real quick. You know, then you don't have 20 people sitting around a table hearing two people debug a problem that they really don't need to be. And it really focuses on trying to, you know, get rid of those big, big Goliath weekly meetings that are always supposed to be an hour, but never end up being an hour.
Exactly. So the next thing is a sprint planning meeting. And we've done this in Agile Task kind of where you know, after an iteration, you sit in, which is usually, iterations in Scrum are typically 7 to 30 days. Mm-hmm. But they can kind of be anything really, is to sit down and select, you know, select the features that you want to work on. And they have various tools to do this. They have this kind of poker,
it's not the flashcards, is it?
You basically, yeah, I mean, you assign a value basically to, okay, to your features, and you have to, you like, if a feature is going to take a long time that has more value, let's say, and then let's say you have to buy, your team has like credits to buy features, and they can either buy this like one and maybe one other feature, or they can work on like four small ones, but they can only select a certain amount of features to go for that sprint.
And a lot of it, I mean, a lot of Scrum type stuff too can be very sort of generically agile, where you have like this, you know, prioritized backlog of stuff from the customer. And if you want, you know, you can select you ones you want to do, or, you know, I mean, there's, again, like with Scrum, it's not, as far as I can tell, I mean, you can sort of implement it how you need. So like you could do a prioritized backlog, you could do flashcards with values where you like auction them off or whatever.
Yep. And so then after you select the features you're going to work on, you, and you're done with that iteration, the next thing is you review like what work got completed, what did not get completed. Mm-hmm. This isn't really the retrospective portion yet. It's just figuring out what features took longer than we expected. Right.
Updating your backlog. You know, like if you didn't actually get a feature done all the way, you have to put that back in your backlog. You know, it's not an actual done feature, sort of that, you know, showing your client, getting feedback from them.
This is also a place where you would show your stakeholders the demo of what you've done. One of the tips here is, you know, incomplete work can't be demonstrated. So always strive to have completed something, you know, some value that you can show your stakeholders, mm-hmm. give them a demo or release to your clients or customers.
Right.
The next one is the retrospective part. And this is where all the team members come back and they reflect on the past sprint. I guess this is less of the demo and showing off the work and, you know, reviewing the work that wasn't completed. And this is more, right, what can we do to improve our future sprints? Right.
That the review is what did happen, like what actually did happen in the sprint. And then the retrospective is knowing what happened in the sprint, how can we improve this process or change it to be better?
Make continuous process improvements. Are we having, you know, is it taking a long time to do a build and compile the code? Can we maybe fix that up so we can develop faster? Right. What's working, what's not working? That's also a Kaizen, which they talk about in the Wikipedia article, which is a Japanese word for continuous improvement, and just kind of thinking back on what works well and what doesn't work. It's always good sound advice.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's time boxed to 3 hours.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Again, time boxing is important because it's get this done in that time.
Yeah, and if you get all the members in and you reflect and you have that time limit, I mean, 3 hours seems like a lot of time, though. But depending on the size of the team, it may require all that time to sit down and really reflect on that.
Well, and again, too, it's one of the things that I know from when I was reading Scrum is there's always, you know, the ability to say, okay, well, you know, Jade, you're really sort of this build time is bothering you. So why don't you, you know, pick a meeting outside of this with a couple other people, schedule a meeting and try and strategize ways to, you know, improve our build time.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that.
If it's bothering one person more than the other, or, you know, a small subset of the team, then they can kind of break off and have their own meeting. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well, kind of. It's just it's time boxed for a reason. And just because you're time boxed doesn't mean that things will drop on the floor, because part of that time boxed meeting can say, all right, well, let's get, you know, the people that care about it, or, you know, the people that are involved in it. Like if one guy's your sysadmin, let's just get me, you know, a couple of us and him together in a meeting outside of this. We don't have to take up everybody's time. You know, we recognize this as a problem. We want to try and prove this in the next iteration. Let's have a meeting to strategize that outside of here. We don't have to solve that problem here now.
Okay. So to reiterate, the basic flow of the Scrum is backlog, and then just the sprint backlog, do the actual sprint, which A lot of people do 4 weeks, but it can be 24 hours. It could be 30 days. But typically it's between, you know, a couple days to 30 days. Mm-hmm. And then work on your sprint and actually have it working by the end of it. Don't have like, you know, features that are half finished or anything like that.
Small chunks of completed work.
We talked a little bit about Kanban in part two, was it?
Yep.
Yeah. So part two, a little bit different is the iterations are actually usually planned in Scrum. Like you say, we're going to release 4 weeks from now, and there's no limit on the work in progress. But for the most part, they're very compatible. And this is kind of the overview of Scrum. Like with extreme programming, you can kind of get into more of the techniques on how to do this, but this is kind of the overall development process with Scrum. Make, you know, small iterations, work until you have a complete demo, and then always review what went well and what didn't work out so well. Mm-hmm. And pretty simple.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have anything else to add?
No, Scrum I think is really cool, just like extreme programming. And the thought is, I mean, we're throwing a lot at you with Kanban, extreme programming, and Scrum and stuff. And what I've heard from people, and I guess I really can't say from experience and whatnot, is that try one of these things completely. One of the problems, I guess I do have a little bit of experience. One of the problems is sometimes you try and just take a little bit from each one and combine them into your own process. And a lot of times what I've read from these sort of agile experts and stuff, they say, you know, don't do that. Try one of them whole in by itself, because really just because you might not think about it, they may have a process in place and probably do to take care of whatever problems might crop up from sort of cherry picking what you like. So, I mean, like sometimes, you know, I've been at work where it's like, hey, let's have like a Scrum meeting, but then we don't do a set iteration with a set retrospective, and that's caused problems in the past. So, I mean, with all these agile things, you know, try and find a book or find a couple really good blog posts, and I would suggest trying to implement it sort of fully before you cherry pick what you like from one, you know, because like I like the Scrum daily stand-up meeting, but you know I like paired programming from extreme programming. But so I guess what I'm saying is before you fully invest in one of these, get some books, read about it. There's some really good Scrum books. There's some really good extreme programming books. I'm not really familiar with Kanban, so check them out fully before you just decide to kind of jump your way into it. Because a lot of times there's definitely more than what Mark and I talk about here in the show, and a lot of times these little processes they come up with, they have processes for figuring out the problems that you come up with that Mark and I, you know, probably didn't talk about in the podcast. So check them out. But if you have any questions or anything, let us know.
Yeah, I think our goal with this episode with this series of episodes is really to just give you an overview of like kind of the philosophies that are out there and to hopefully spark some interest in maybe developing your, maybe you're a lone developer and you're going to like this next one. Or maybe you want to, you know, you're already doing this next one, but you want to improve and maybe kind of go to some of these other ones and try them. So if anything, just, you know, to bring them out in the light and for you to go check them out further. So the next one to get through this is Code Cowboy.
It's not really, yeah. So this isn't like an agile one, right? I mean, this is sort of its own category,
like an
right?
Anti-philosophy.
Yeah. Okay.
So I've definitely ridden the dusty trails of the Code Cowboy way in my day. And I still do to some degree, just because I'm the only programmer where I work. I do a lot of projects that are, you know, just a single developer. And so I've kind of had to, I can't pair program with myself. I can't have stand-up meetings by myself.
What? How?
I can talk to you. Go ahead. Sorry.
I think you should be able to have pair programming with yourself.
So the Code Cowboy, So in the agile community, it's kind of used as a derogatory type. Yes. Well, I mean, you know, like
it's a negative
connotation.
Yeah.
Programmer basically that is going along and just hacking on code and
Yeah, usually like a lone developer in part of a group or a group or by himself or with a group of developers, but usually working sort of alone. Minimal process or discipline, kind of just does what he needs to, because typically it hasn't been a problem, right? Usually if they're a lone developer, you know, it doesn't matter if you use perfect source code management, because no one else is going to see it. It's just you, and that's okay. And yeah, I mean, I agree. It's not, a lot of times if you are the single developer, the code cowboy is, you know, that's what you are. You really, I mean, sometimes it is just more efficient and it's harder to convince your boss that you need these services and processes and stuff in place when you're the only one working there, you know, but that happens.
Yeah. So, I mean, oftentimes I focus on fixing things, you know, applying, I like to call it kind of like applying band-aids over stuff. Mm-hmm. Usually by the end, you just have band-aids all over the place and it becomes just a mess.
Yeah.
So it's something to kind of keep in mind when you're going about programming. Oftentimes when you do like these little quick little band-aids, a little fix, it gets you in the end. Usually, you know, when you're code cowboying, you're not using version control. When I first started test programming, I didn't even know about version control. I didn't know about unit tests. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really, you know, get into continuous integration or any of the build tools. You know, if you are a single developer, I guess my advice would be to research some of these philosophies, try to add some of them. You know, you obviously can't do the meetings and things, but you can, you know, have iterations, even if it's by yourself and no one's going to say anything. If you didn't meet your own deadline, you should kind of strive to have iterations and try to show demos to people, try to get user stories and get acceptance tests. Like when you're done finishing the code, take it and see, be like, is this going to work for you? Things like that.
Yeah. And the thing is, the way I look at it is it's hard to do these processes, but really doing them and documenting them is a great thing, because think about, like you were talking about the book E-Myth, where they talk about how, you know, treat every business as if you're trying to franchise it. And like, so that's an important part. Like the truth is I'm not a good code cowboy because I'm a process freak. I love processes and I love trying to think of my own. Even when I do software by myself, I'm doing SCM with like proper, you know, all this goofy stuff just in case, like if I ever add another developer, I want it to go as smoothly as possible. And that's sort of a way to think about, like, what if where you're working, things exploded? Like for some reason tomorrow, everyone loves your product and you have to, you know, double or triple your team size, you know, from 1 to 3 people. How would that work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good thought exercise for sure. You know, there are some advantages. There's often some programmers that are just extraordinary and they like the free form working environment. They can make prototypes really quick without, you know, starting to doing tests and starting, you know, picking features. They just kind of go. Smaller projects can often be burdened by, you know, some of these methodologies. Sometimes,
yeah,
it, you know, like one night of heavy duty cowboy coding might get a, you know, a prototype that's actually usable, and then maybe you could rewrite it or fix it up later.
Right. I mean, that's a problem I've run in with is I get so process heavy, even with a small one man project that probably will never blow up. You know, I'll go in my project tracker, I'll make a project and I'll start putting in issues and versions. It's like, do you need versions for this goofy one-off thing that you're just doing for yourself? And, you know, for me, it's like I do that and yeah, and it gets burned down, it gets slowed down. So there, you know, sometimes there is a time to cowboy and a time to not.
Absolutely. And that's, I mean, that's about it, I guess, with the code cowboy. Just, I mean, I don't know, try to strive for a better, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, as you are a professional with tools, both mental tools and physical and software tools, so you know try and use the best tools possible. Like I look at it as, you know, if you're a code cowboy, you can try and make some of these lightweight, you know, a lot of these agile processes are very lightweight, so you could try and implement them, see if they make you know a little bit better. You're always going to have a stakeholder somehow, and then sometimes look at it like, we, you know, you see this a lot with sort of, I mean, you see these where these people have these sort of really complex systems that are full of, like what you're saying, band-aids, band-aid after band-aid after band-aid. And then after a while, you know, it's they're just sort of secure in their own little world with all their band-aids, that the only reason they're still around is that they're the only one that can figure out this ridiculously complex system, where if they, you know, try and had a system in place, like where they said, you know, okay, once a week, my part of my iteration is to, you know, fix any bugs and refactor code, you know, then it's like, oh, well, you know what? Then that's less overhead in general in the end. So, you know, it's just always better to try and improve yourself, improve your process. If you can even create your own sort of code cowboy process that is, you know, that works for you and helps keep things clean and useful, that's, you're better off than when you were at the beginning.
Yep.
So check it out. Hey, any thoughts, especially on the Code Cowboy stuff, because I know there's a couple of you out there, and I'm curious kind of what you've done to help make your workflow better and make your workflow, you know, not quite as grungy. Or if you just, you know, if you are a Code Cowboy out there and all you do is get pushback from your management because you can't implement any good workflows or anything. We want to hear from you guys, so let us know. That wraps up for this episode and for our three-part series in software development philosophies. Please send us some feedback, what you think about it. If we missed stuff or if we forgot about one thing, let us know. We'd love to hear from you guys. If you haven't subscribed to the show, I want to remind you, you can do so by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe, faceoffshow.com/feedback to let us know what you think. Thank you for listening. We really appreciate it, and we will see you guys next week.